in the writing of this chapter.
Beautiful.
Well, you know, Donald Trump has never said, I'm no crook. I'm not a crook.
But yet. yeah, I agree with that. So we have to go. Any last thoughts, Paulette?
No, this was a beautiful show.
I agree. And if you'd like to make contact, you can do that at heartofmindradio@gmail.com. If you need any further information or want to communicate, that's the way to do that. Stay tuned. Coming up, Hour of the Wolf with Jim Froin. Black or a light to keep on and come on, shake up the nations. We'll need ventilation, a tainted information gathered in the bottom of the.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, a pre-recorded program with guest Kidge Johnson. Stay tuned. And once again, good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and I'm going to be playing for you an interview and a reading from Tuesday, November 15th of this year, where Kidge Johnson and Sonia Taaffe were our readers, and this program features Kidge Johnson. Kitch Johnson writes short stories and occasional novels and has won the Hugo, Nebula, World Fantasy, and Sturgeon Awards. Her latest books are the Tor.com novella, The Dream Quest of Velit Bo, and The Riverbank, coming out from Small Bear Press in 2017. Currently, she teaches creative writing at the University of Kansas, where she is also the associate director for the Gunn Center for the Study of Science Fiction. She splits her time between Seattle and Lawrence. She taught writing and science fiction at Louisiana State University and at U of Kansas, and she has lectured on creativity and writing at bookstores and businesses across the country. Since 2004, Kitch teaches the Center's intensive science fiction and fantasy novel writing workshop. From 1999 through 2004, she taught a series of writing classes at the Gen Con Game Fair. She taught at the 2011 Clarion Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers Workshop. In the past 10 years, she has worked as a managing editor at Tor Books, collections and special editions editor for Dark Horse Comics, editor, continuity manager, and creative director for Wizards of the Coast, program manager on Microsoft Reader, and managing editor of user communications at Real Networks. As a side effect of the current economy, she made the jump to writing full-time, then completed an MFA in creative writing in Raleigh, North Carolina. Kitch has run chain and independent bookstores, worked as a radio announcer and engineer, edited cryptic crosswords, and waitressed in a strip bar. So, in other words, another underachiever. So with that, we're going to take you. We used all three floors of 388 Atlantic Avenue. We popped up to WBAI on the third floor. We recorded the interview in two different rooms on the second floor of the building. And then we held the presentation of the Nursef readings on the ground floor. So set your Wayback Machine and meet Kitch Johnson. Kitch said, bring it on, so it is on. Okay.
It has been brought. Excellent.
And I can tell people that it is November 15th of the year 16, or I should say the year of disaster plus 1 week.
Yes, yes. And, D-Day plus seven.
Yeah, we probably, you know, we may need a new numbering system for dating things.
Right.
We now live in an alternate universe.
Right. We're on a countdown now instead of a count up.
Yeah. Yeah. But we shall see. At any rate, I have met you before very briefly in passing at the Nebula Awards maybe 7 years ago, were they in New York?
Right.
When the Grandmaster was James E. Gunn.
When it was Jim Gunn. Yes. Yeah. It was a delight to be here. I hadn't been back to New York since I had moved out 15 years before.
Right.
So many things had changed.
Oh, yeah.
One thing that had not changed was the taxi drivers wanting to talk politics. That will always be with us, I think.
Yeah, sadly.
And
I never want to talk politics.
I never want to talk politics.
Not when they were good and not now when they're bad. Actually, I do have one political thing on my agenda, and it's a very specific one. The question being, and I'll even put it to you, how is speculative fiction going to change, given the change in the sea weather of our politics? I would just preface that by saying it is easy to read certain stories and see that they're post 9/11, or they're Bush era, or they're Reagan era,
right?
Or they're, for that matter, Roosevelt. Either.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Cold War stories. I mean, we always talked about the Cold War stories.
Yeah.
And I don't know. My feeling is that we're going to see a lot of anger turning up, a lot of very dark stories. I'm already working on very dark stories. I have a feeling that we will also see some people will step back into sort of airy fantasies, you know, getting away from...
Escapist.
Classic escapist stuff.
That's all I have been reading for a week now.
Right, exactly.
Catherine Valenti,
Mm-hmm. Agatha Christie.
Right. Yeah, I went back and I started reading old Hal Clement again because Mission of Gravity is one of the great comfort books of all time.
Thank you. I haven't read that.
Oh, it's so fun.
In long enough years.
It is my go-to. I'm on a mission to collect every single secondhand paperback copy of Mission of Gravity so that when I die, I can be like sent off to sea in a Viking longboat filled with them, which will then light. That's how I'm going to go.
Except you don't want them to burn those books, though.
Well, there's a lot of them, it turns out. A lot of paperback copies of Mission of Gravity.
Okay. And, yeah, but is it... Is it in ebook form?
Who knows? Yeah. I have 50,000 tiny paperbacks.
I am of the belief that there isn't a book that shouldn't be in ebook form because it doesn't degrade as quickly as even well-kept dead trees. And also audiobooks because, well, I make them.
I'd always say, yes, that's also helpful. You know, the paper copies, you know, that groundwood pulp does not last well. But there's something so delicate about the old paperbacks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's something about cracking them open. And I read a lot of old paperbacks.
Yeah.
Not just every copy of Mission of Gravity in North America. But there's something about the artifact of the delicate old book.
Yeah.
And there's a gravity even to reading, you know, non-essential books. I've also got paperback copies of The Complete Enchanter, which I've
by
been...
By L. Sprague DeKalb.
Right, and Fletcher.
We have to tell
Fletcher
listeners
Pratt.
This,
Fletcher Pratt.
Yeah. I never met Fletcher Pratt.
I never met either of them,
actually. I met Sprague a number of times. He was a blowhard like Lynn Carter, but he was wonderful at it.
He had the best facial hair in the industry, I think.
Yeah, I dare say.
It was pretty. Every picture I've ever seen, he had like a splendid beard. And he had fantastic eyebrows, too. It's like the combo was special.
Alfred Bester.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm an enormous Bester fan.
Yeah.
Every so often, although I wouldn't say it's exactly comfort reading, but every so often I go back and I reread Stars My Destination and Demolished Man.
Mm-hmm.
Demolished Man, not a comforting read, but a very interesting one.
It is.
And I think it'll be interesting now
to reread. Actually, when people get to the... I have reread it in the last year. And it's interesting because, yes, it's a murder mystery.
Yes.
We're not giving anything away there.
No.
But...
No spoilers.
It's... No, there's no spoiler in there because I think you know by page 3.
Right.
But... what is the surprise there is the last, the denouement.
Yeah. It's a very twisty story, and it's a very twisty ending. And that's something Bester did fantastically well, actually.
But it's actually almost a positive twist in its bizarre way.
Right. Absolutely. Marvelous. He was such an amazing writer.
Yeah.
And really, we didn't see enough from him, because everything we did see from him was kind of genius.
Oh, yeah, very much so. But in the last third of his career, he went back to science fiction and he was writing, the 4-Hour Fugue, was it?
Yeah, was it? I can't remember the title.
Yeah, but The Man Who Can Smell Anything.
Right,
which would have been a different legitimate title for what it was. And again, the denouement of that, what it is that he can smell.
Fondly Fahrenheit. By Bester. Also, twisty leading up to a fiendish little denouement.
I would argue, pardon me, that despite some of the best novels, well, the two that he had and wonderful short stories, I think Fondly Fahrenheit may be his masterwork.
I think there's something. He was so playful linguistically. I mean, he was just incredible to read, and I read him out loud. There are a lot of books I read out loud because I'm a very fast reader, and the only way to slow down to really appreciate the grace notes is to read it out loud. And he is somebody that is never not a delight.
Yeah.
And Fondly Fahrenheit, because there's like word games being played inside of it, little jingly things that are delightful.
Yeah.
All with this sort of dark. Very dark undertone. So it's kind of fantastic work.
In the heat. I'll read. Yeah.
I've
performed that story on the air a few times.
Yeah.
and each time you can take it in a different direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and I always think that that's, as somebody who's done audiobooks and who reads aloud a lot, a story that you, where you can reread aloud five times and get five different sort of emphases, five different flavors out of the same paragraph is always a delight to me.
Yeah, yeah. And it, and there's so much going on. This is a classic story. This is the kind of thing that they are still trying to emulate in current media, like Mr. Robot.
Mm-hmm. Right, absolutely.
The ideas in Mr. Robot probably derive somewhat from Bester.
Mm-hmm.
If you think about
if not,
it.
If not at the first hand, then second hand or
exactly.
subsequent.
Exactly.
But yeah, absolutely.
You know, because Bester isn't the only person to use an unreliable narrator, yes. but he did but he did it the best.
He did it the best. I agree. Unreliable narrators. And the best non-mystery writing.
Yeah.
I would say. Because like Jim Thompson in Mysteries mm-hmm. does better unreliable narrators, but that's Mysteries.
Yes.
Killer Inside Me is fantastic work.
It absolutely is, but they're both genre,
right?
So
absolutely.
they do share,
and true in their hearts to the genres they're working in too.
Yeah,
I love that about Jim Thompson mm-hmm. as well.
So we've been talking about unreliable narrators in genre literature, but we should talk a little bit about Kitch Johnson.
Also an unreliable narrator.
Ooh, do tell.
Well, one is always an unreliable narrator, but
I think so. I think so, we all are.
To
and,
some
and
extent.
We're moving into an unreliable era. There I go again. I'm obsessed.
Yeah, well, it's hard not to be right now.
It really is.
I'm
it
on
really
news
is.
Blackout, what I call kitten down a well.
Yeah.
Where I will only, my friends know not to tell me anything unless it's about a kitten that was rescued from a well. So KDAW. So kitten down a well alert right now.
KDAW, I like mm-hmm. that a lot. Kadaw.
Kadaw, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, which is about, what, yeah, I think about what is my brain like, it's kadaw.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah. So, when did you start selling, publishing and or selling your writing?
I didn't start writing until I was 25, and I started selling right away. But the very first thing I ever sold was to Tales of the Unanticipated, which you as an old-timer may know. It was produced by the Minnesota Science Fiction Society every 9 months for some reason. That was, I had been a gaming fan. I'd gone to Gen Con before, but I started writing at 25 and immediately sold my very first story. Second story.
Which
first
was?
Story wasn't a story. It was called Roadkill. And
I read that.
I can't believe you would have, because I have attempted to bury that story.
If
it's not a bad story.
One got fanzines in those days.
Yes.
They came right off of the yes. Gestetner mm-hmm. machines, and they got passed through. I was at a point in my life overactive in fandom.
Oh, as indeed were many people.
And
I was paid for it, but it was a quarter cent a word, so yeah. It was $8.25, I think, something like that. It might have been less. And it was, I was proud as punch of it. And then I wrote an epic limerick, which I did for free for a for an APA.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just started to sell things. So I sold a story to, I went to Clarion West in 2 years after I started writing, and I sold a story to Tappan King while I was there. I started to sell it to Pulp House.
Mm-hmm.
And then nothing much happened for a while.
Tappan King was at Twilight Zone?
He was at Twilight Zone.
Yes, okay.
For a while.
That was a good magazine.
It was a really good magazine.
It had nothing really to do with
the movie or the show at all.
The show,
right.
Except that Carol Serling gave her blessings to it.
I had a novella come out through the Tor.com novella series that Jonathan Strahan bought, because my affection for Jonathan is such that he is the only person I will write for spec on spec for
wow.
anymore. Just writing on spec is a profession of misery for me. And Jonathan,
and is frowned upon by most professional organizations, listeners, unless you're a professional.
Right.
Don't do this at home.
Right, yeah, unless you know. And I don't like having contracts on things I haven't written yet.
Yeah,
like
if an agent says, oh, write something for me and I'll consider.
No, don't do it.
Run away.
Don't do it.
Go to writers beware.
Right.
And report
double
them
check.
And run away.
Yeah, I know way too many horror stories about writers with very solid careers who had them effectively cratered by agents asking them to write novels on spec.
Exactly.
That they then were not willing to sell.
Yeah.
This is a really bad idea.
Yeah.
And it's a really, really destructive place to be, too. Depending on what your relationship with your agent is, it can be toxic. It can destroy a career.
Yeah. And a proper agent wouldn't ask.
Well, I think some proper agents will ask, but I think that a proper agent who then requests something like that and then realizes they can't sell it will usually let you have... They'll understand that you will want to sell it somehow. They won't hold you to
took a year of your life. Yes,
exactly.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what my concern with even writing shorter stuff on, you know, for other people.
Well, shorter stuff can take longer to write.
It's the truth. I'm working on a novelette right now that is taking longer than the book that's coming out next year from Small Beer, which I finished in 2 months.
I love Small Beer.
I do, too.
There is a quote that I use on the air all the time, and I will expect, and nobody knows who said this, but you will.
Perhaps.
The quote is, a novel is a lovely thing. You can meander as long as you want. But, and here comes the important part of the quote, a short story is a polished gem.
Mm-hmm. I always think there's a British...
You haven't identified.
It's Henry James?
No.
No, but he did say that novels are the way that you essentially earn your short fiction
career.
Yeah,
but right. But no.
No, I do not know who it is.
Somebody with the name James.
Oh.
E. Gunn.
Okay.
Jim Gunn.
Jim says so many things that are of value. In fact, he's probably said it to me. I have breakfast with him every Saturday.
I've only once met him and mm-hmm. spoke to him and did not get to interview him. But this is from an introduction to a book about the craft of science fiction.
Right. The Science of Science Fiction Writing. Is that the one?
No. It's older than that.
Right. Yeah, Jim is...
This is from the 70s that he wrote this.
Jim has a gift for the perfect mordant quote.
Yes.
Which is widely adopted without anybody knowing who said it.
Yeah. No, I quote people. I appropriate mm-hmm. things. I appropriated from Douglas Adams when web addresses were still relatively new. And people didn't want to say www. Yeah, so what Douglas said is trouble you.
Sure, why not?
You know, and of course, by the way, listeners, you never need to use that. Even when you write it out, spell it out, the web doesn't care.
The
browsers put it in automatically. So, but Douglas used, his website was www.tdv.org, the Digital Village. .org. It was his nonprofit, and I started saying "trouble you" all the time because I thought it was marvy and wonderful. And on his next trip to the States,
yeah.
I mentioned it to him, and he said, "Oh, that's clever. Where did you get that from?" And I said, "From you." He said, "I never."
Oh, he should have known better by then. He should have said, "Why, yes, of course I said that."
Well, eventually.
Naturally, I said that.
I convinced him.
Was it good?
Him.
Did you like it? I said it.
Yes. No, he was an appropriator himself.
Right.
Anybody who knows their Robert Sheckley and listens to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy
can
attest.
Yeah. Yep.
So.
Absolutely.
I mean, Magrathea, Marvin the Robot, really? I read about him in 1958. Well, I didn't read it in 58, but...
So. Yeah, I didn't read him in 58 either.
No, I would have been 5.
I was an enormous Sheckley fan back in the day.
Same here. I have not stopped.
He was splendid.
Yeah.
And he was somebody... I worked for my sins. I did novelizations when I worked at Dark Horse Comics, and I worked with Janice Silverstein over at Bantam, and Sheckley wrote several for us, and so I would visit him in his studio in Portland, which was always very entertaining because, of course, because the man and the sort of legendary writer that I had been reading were perfectly in sync and yet utterly different. Yeah. Which was highly entertaining to me.
He was another person I never really got to interview because he would start stuttering when the mic was on.
Right, right.
But I've gotten the rest of his, well, of a portion of his family because he's married so many times.
Right.
But you mentioned Dark Horse Comics.
Right,
so
yeah.
You know Alyssa Quitney, perhaps.
No, I have worked everywhere for 2 years at a time.
Well, she is at Dark Horse now.
Right, and I was there in the early 90s.
Do you know her birth name?
No.
Oh, it's Sheckley.
Oh. Oh, okay.
Alyssa Quitney writes, the way I found this out is I was at the KGB Fantastic Fiction series that Ellen Datlow and Matt Kressel run, and when they're all filled up, they send people like you to me. Thank you, Ellen.
Hi, Ellen.
And she says, that's Ellen. Yes, if she comes tonight, we'll find out.
It'd be lovely.
They have a reading tomorrow. I feel terrible about that. We don't like to step on each other's toes. Two readings in 1 week.
Right, right.
You know? And that was my fault. That was totally my fault. But
sorry, Ellen.
Yeah. I did my mea culpa on the air already.
Yeah.
And in print and the event thing and all that. And I called her out on Facebook and said, I didn't mean to do it. Anyway. So Datlow had booked this woman named Alyssa Quitney, who writes romance fiction. Big seller, as romance fiction is wont to be. And she writes some supernatural romance, occasionally. And so this woman comes into the KGB bar, comes up and, like, smooches Datlow. Hello, which is generally
unusual.
Not the way the majority of people
most
say
of us
hi
don't
to
do
Ellen.
That.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And and I'm thinking, okay, that's different. And then whoever was the first reader went up, and the second reader, Alyssa Quitney, gets up, and she says, "Well, this is comedy, supernatural." And a bit of romance, because that's what sells. But because it is comedy and supernatural and fantastic fiction, for these stories, I will use my birth name, which is Alyssa Sheckley. And, of course, Ellen worked at Omni with Robert Sheckley and knew little Alyssa.
Right, exactly.
Therefore, the smooch, because she knew Alyssa from, age 4 or 5.
Exactly. And well, that's fun.
And since then, we did a Robert Sheckley tribute. We do tributes occasionally at the reading series.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had Ziva Quitney, Sheckley's umpteenth wife, the one who was with him from, 1953 through 1974, something like. So let's say the good years.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and she was his editor and muse and more.
Mm-hmm.
No
right,
doubt.
So, right.
I think you can actually judge a lot of Sheckley's writing by to whom he was married at the time.
That may not be wrong, actually.
It may not be wrong. So I have ingratiated myself to the Quitney family and Ziva Quitney, who is very much still with us and a wonderful person. Is a prominent psychologist who knew Margot Adler's father, of course.
Right, right. Bless you.
Pardon. So there you go.
Right.
There really are only so many people in the world, or at least so many concentric circles that bring us together.
Right, exactly.
So I just had to mention that because you said Dark Horse.
Right.
And I believe that Ziva is current. Ziva. Alyssa Quitney. Oh, I like that sound.
It's very science fictiony.
It really is.
I'd like to think it's the aliens coming for us. Well, so if we suddenly start saying different things, that would be why.
Yeah, it is actually a communicator.
Yeah, it is.
It is.
Old school.
Yes,
old school.
Very much
so. It's attached to the wall.
Yeah.
So it's not, we can't exactly take it with on away expeditions or anything like that.
But we can attach a phone to it and use that instead.
Excellent.
You know, a Wi-Fi phone.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Don't have to pay the telco companies. Just use the Wi-Fi.
Right. Good plan.
Yeah, absolutely. I do that at home. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
So, what was your when? How and when did you publish your first novel?
Thereby hangs a tale. So I, through a sort of strange series of events, I went to Clarion West. One of my Clarion West buddies, we were the editing year.
Which year was that?
1987. And okay. So, among others that year, Gordon Van Gelder, Michael J. Stearns, who's now an agent. There were many, Kathleen Alcala, who mm-hmm. did Raven Chronicles. Ron Drummond, who's a Seattle book.
I know. I know his name,
And there were others as well. And a few years later, when I moved to New York City, I was looking for a job, and I contacted Gordon, and he said, well, you could, you know, I understand there's a position open at Tor, so I applied and I got in. And then the production staff, it was a production staff position, but the production staff all quit in one day. And so Maria Malilli and I suddenly were the production staff. And
oh, my.
Taking on 650 books a year or whatever it was. With
I trust we'll have a good portion of Tor books here tonight.
2 weeks of permission, or 2 weeks of training at that point.
Yeah, not Tom. I was actually there yesterday. But
so I got into the Bob Howe and John Ordover, and I decided it'd be really fun to do a collection of Coney Island stories, because we're all big fans.
You did that. Oh, God.
Well, they ended up finishing it.
Yes.
But I was part of it. And we asked Bob Gleason. It was fun. And most of the stuff got reprinted because it took us so long to print it.
Yeah.
So it was like Dangerous Visions, except not. And we, one of the things we got is that we knew Bob Gleason had been a Western writer, and we knew that Bat mm-hmm. Masterson had spent his twilight years basically doing stuff on Coney Island. So it was my job to ask him if he would write us a short story, and he said, I'll write you a short story if you write me an outline based on this short story, which had I had just had a short story come out called Fox Magic, which was from Asimov's.
Yes.
And so in order to get the Bat Masterson story out of Bob Gleason, I wrote this outline, but I didn't know how to write an outline. I had no idea how to write a novel. So the outline was 100 pages long. It was just every...
It's a good head start.
Yeah, exactly. That's the way it happened. The whole novel happened by accretion. So instead of ever building a structure, I would just be like, well, here's a scene that actually... I put some narrative in, so maybe I could turn that narrative into its own scene. So I do that. And so this whole story just evolved. It just sort of seethed outwards, like foaming caulk that mm-hmm. you would use. So it just kind of keeps seething, and it just got bigger and bigger. It was at 100 pages when I gave it to him, and he gave me the Bat Masterson story. And at that point, he said, we'd like to make you an offer. And I was like, Right, so 7 years later, I finally finished the book, because I didn't know how to write a novel.
Yeah,
so it was a very slow undertaking. And it was, so it came out well after I'd moved to Seattle, and I was working at Wizards of the Coast at that point. And
the gaming background again.
Right. So I sort of scrambled around, it won the Crawford Award from ICFA that year. So I was back for that, and that was a huge amount of fun.
But we have to tell listeners, ICFA is the International Conference on Fantastic
for the
Arts.
Fantastic and the Arts.
And the Arts, okay.
It's an organization that's an interesting hybrid of scholarly and academic work, and then creatives. And so their conference, their annual conference, which is held in March in Orlando, which might be seen as a junket for professors, actually ends up being a really, really cool event, because it's a combination of very smart talk about writing.
Except it's always opposite one of my other favorite events. And
yeah, it is. There is something. It overlaps with something. Yeah. I can't remember what.
It's either WISCON or ReaderCon.
No, it's not WISCON and it's not ReaderCon, because WISCON is Memorial Day weekend and ReaderCon is usually the 4th of July, isn't it?
After the 4th
right,
of July,
yeah.
Not long after.
So I can't remember what it is. When is but there is like an overlap. It's March.
Oh, it's in March.
Maybe
okay.
It's Easter.
it might be BossCon or Rigia or Lunacon.
Oh, it could be, yeah.
One of those.
Yeah, it could be BossCon, yeah. Actually, now that I think about it. But it's always very small. It's the gateway drug when I'm suggesting to new writers and new people who are just getting started, and they're saying, well, should I go to cons and what cons should I go to? I usually tell them to go to that one if they're fantasy writers, because just the chances of actually meeting people that they would want to meet are so high.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nobody dresses up or anything really, which is sad. But on the other hand, you will meet lots and lots of very interesting people.
Yeah, I say exactly the same thing about ReaderCon, and ReaderCon is cheaper to go to.
Many
but
people do.
But you can't visit Cape Canaveral.
You can't visit Cape Canaveral, and it's not in March when you need to get away from Minnesota or Seattle.
Yeah.
You need to see the sun again. You need to remember that somewhere out there, there are people whose faces have a little bit of burn on them. So,
yeah.
So, yeah, you go to Florida just to remember how the other half lives.
But fans don't have, they don't get they don't, any color. They don't see
true.
Any sun.
They just turn red.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
That's about it. Usually apoplectically so.
Often.
Yes.
Often.
Our little community here. And that book for our listeners was called?
It was called The Fox Woman. I felt a very slow moving book. And I was, later on, I ended up writing a second book that was also set in the same period, more or less the same period. So, Heian period Japan. The first book was set at about 1,000, and the second book was set in 1178 or something like that. And the second book was much faster to write, also did very well for itself. So I was happy with both of them. At the time, I thought I might write a third book, I still have the outline.
You haven't ruled it out, yeah.
Have not. I have the outline on my wall, and I have all of my research books. I didn't sell them or anything because I sell a lot of books. I know that's like anathema to many people, but I kept my Japanese research library, at least the part of it that's relevant to the next book.
Mm-hmm. So from there, now you've also done reading aloud. Now I'm a radio person.
Right.
You know,
yeah.
Before books on tape existed, we had books on radio. First project
reading
I was
stories on, you know, story hours and
well,
things like
we
that.
Were doing full radio dramas at WBAI when I started there in, God help me, 1967.
Right.
Samuel R. Delaney was producing The Star Pit,
uh-huh.
This novella.
Uh-huh.
That he was the narrator of.
Right.
The script girl.
Those were the days.
Okay, yes, but when I give you the name,
yes.
The script girl was Joanna Russ.
Oh.
So.
Oh, my.
So she had to let that one down.
Yeah.
Actually, she used to boast it.
Yes. Well,
from people that
she
knew.
She would think that was pretty funny, I would think.
Oh, she did. She
right.
Did. You know, and
for Chip, especially.
I was prepubescent, so I didn't count. And she was like the only, it was her and Tom Dish and Baird Searles was running the group, if you know who he is.
Oh, man, that's amazing.
Well, he was the drama and literature director of
right.
BAI. He was the first person I worked
right,
for.
Right, right.
And that's how I met Chip,
mm-hmm.
because Chip was working for Baird and Tom Dish. So
excellent.
So Joanna was, at the time, the only straight person. I mean, I guess I was, but I was prepubescent, so it didn't count.
Pre-straight.
I was pre-straight, exactly. Exactly. And I had Chip actually as my protector, because there were just so many very happy gay men around at the
uh-huh.
time, or very gay happy men around, one of those two.
Mm-hmm.
So, so I started with radio drama in the late 60s.
Oh, yeah.
And then when Baird left to open the science fiction shop, which was the first of its kind in the country, where the cashier was Beth Meacham.
Oh.
And I was the stock boy.
Uh-huh.
And I was down in the Village. And you were probably right. In New York around then, weren't
No, I was
you?
In New York 90 to 92-ish.
Oh, okay. So this is so after.
After that.
This is after, yeah. Because I'm talking 69 through 71.
See, I would have visited that year.
You would have.
Yeah, my
and
family.
And I would have known you then.
You might have if my parents had taken me there because I was 9.
Right.
So we went to the Natural History Museum a lot.
Okay, yes, as I still do.
As one does, yeah.
Yes, and I worked at another museum, so I go in mm-hmm. pretending to be a colleague, even though all that I did was network work, computer
right.
arrangement.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But hey, I worked at Liberty Science Center, so I worked in a museum.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Good enough. 1 second, I just got a thing, and
newsflash.
I'm hoping it is... No, it is Ornover.
What, again?
Yes. Sigh.
He'll be sad about is that many of my former students are here, and this is the first time I've seen many of them.
Yeah.
In anything from a year to 20 years. So I'm Good. Really excited
you
to see
Well, you
them.
Don't get to New York a lot.
I don't come here very much.
You were here for the Nebula Awards, as
right.
I was talking about.
And I was here on a flyby last fall on my way back from Iceland. No. Where was I?
Right,
oh, I had
right.
gone on a cruise with my mother,
mm-hmm.
and we came through New York, and instead of flying straight back, I stopped off for a couple of days.
You're doing a tour right now, aren't you? This is
No, I'm actually here for reasons other than this. But
oh, okay.
As long as I was going to be here for a couple of days, I thought I would... See if there's any chance I could do a reading, because I've always, it is the dream to do a reading in New York.
Well, any
now I will have.
Any time you are here, if I don't have a reading available, I will have a radio show available.
Sure, that sounds fantastic.
You know, that because it's, well, since 1972 and still going, and if something happens to the station, which it could, because we eat our young.
As indeed.
We have met the enemy, and it is us. We don't even... Actually, the new external enemy may help solidify us, because we're beyond left, you know, we're raving crazies there.
Raving crazies.
Yes, I'm proud to say. Well... Somewhat proud. We used to have raving crazies on both sides of the spectrum, and I thought that was better.
Actually, it's usually much more interesting.
Well, we had radio shows that were Bill Buckley and Abby Hoffman.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
and
that's fantastic.
They loved each other. They
both
loved
so smart.
Each other.
That would be a really interesting conversation.
It was. They're available in the Pacifica archives.
Well, there you are.
Which also has to do fundraising, so mm-hmm. I put on my yucky voice there.
Promotional voice.
Yeah. Well, actually, when I read promos on the air, I speak like this. This is my Lightspeed magazine voice,
mm-hmm.
and this is my radio announcing voice. Only,
right.
only then I get closer to the mic. Whereas, but when I try to, well, you know. But anyway, I interject too much. But that's why I call these chats, not interviews.
Chats. I know it makes them. It gives you a lot more flexibility.
It really
I think.
Does. It really does.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to talk about so much more. What are you working on now?
I am
a real
right
question.
Now sort of between projects. Yeah, exactly. I'm between major projects. I did 3 big projects in a row just without a break, and I wanted to do some short stuff after that.
Yay.
And then this novelette
okay.
I'm working on is just grinding on endlessly, and every time things change it gets darker, so it abruptly Ooh. Became much darker. After this, I'll do some more short stuff, and then come January, I'm expecting to start a new project, and right now I'm sort of taking votes among my friends about which one of about 5 ideas I have I'm going to advance on. But it'll be a book, that one will be a book or a very short book, like a, you know, that 50,000 word, you know, technically mm-hmm. a novella, but not quite, because
yeah.
it's... Yeah, because it's a little too big for a novella, even.
And they don't do ace doubles anymore.
No, and I love that length. It turns out it's an incredible length. Manabridge the Mist was 28,000. That came out a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And then Velvet Bow ends up being about 38,000, although there was a draft that was 60,000. Which I ground.
You see, these need audiobooks.
Right, but. Right. Well, it's well that I cut it because it's a better book now. But yes, that mid range, that 50, that
it's
30
a
to 60,000 range is a beautiful length for science fiction.
It is.
And fantasy, but it's just not really, except for the Tor.com and a few other, Publishing. There aren't a lot of places where you can publish anything that length if you don't self-publish.
There's Clark's World, there's Lightspeed.
Well, they don't. Clark's World's top line is something like 14,000.
But you know what? You twist Neil Clark's arm.
Right.
You twist Joseph Adams' arm.
There's always an exception.
There is always an exception. These are very approachable people, you know. And
they are. Since Neil is my go-to for everything short I write, I always try Neil. First, because he's, although I may change that up with the next project. I'm not sure yet. It depends on how long it ends up being. So I'm at 13,000 words in.
Come to, we've done stuff 13. About that length for Lightspeed.
Yeah.
We did an Andrea Hairston story that the podcast was, it was so long that we actually did the podcast in two parts because it was about an hour 45 minutes. And the story deserved a slow telling.
Right, yeah. Some things you do not want to rush. Presentation, I mean, just thinking about audiobooks in general, it's like presentation and pacing and all is so interesting. I can't listen to audiobooks because there are very few people who I like how they read. And certain authors, people with twisty syntax, in order to read them properly requires like real chops, linguistic chops. And on top of that, then having to add all of these other things, you know, the pacing and the inflection and stuff like that. It's really fun and interesting, but it's also hard work.
Yeah, but the people I work with are all professionals.
That's always nice. Yeah.
We just did Dahlgren.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If you want to talk about a project, a book with marginalia, how
exactly.
do you bring that to audio? Well, there are ways.
Right. Footnote stories and experimental. Because I'm a formalist, I do an awful lot of experimental stuff. But there's no real way to publish conventionally.
Yeah.
So it's always fun to try to figure out how, you know, if you have a story that is a playing card story, for instance, how do you read that? How do you do that as an audio book?
There are ways.
It's fascinating
there are ways.
To think that through.
And we do better special effects than anybody in Marvelville. So
awesome, yeah.
I don't have to sell you, maybe the audience, but I don't have to sell you on the glories of radio drama.
Oh,
and
so
I
much
love
fun.
Full cast radio drama. Mm-hmm. And we're still doing those.
Right, sure.
And and had we the facility, we don't have the facilities right now at WBAI, but it's we don't even have a soundproof room, but it's a lovely building.
Right.
We're on the third floor. We're right, Kidge and I are right now, listeners, as you can see, we're on the second floor.
Picture, if you will.
Yeah, indeed.
Tan walls.
Well, actually, people can.
Ceilings that almost go, or walls that almost go to the ceiling, and yet not quite.
And that's exactly the, believe it or not, the control room at BA. Oh, I just realized we are in what one floor up is the control room.
Oh.
And it has the same problem with the ceilings. We cordoned it off, and then the fire department took a look, and we had Jiffy bags, cartons of Jiffy bags,
right?
And it actually worked for soundproofing and all.
Yeah,
that. And
absolutely.
The fire department just said, "Thou shalt not be soundproofed."
That's
without
right.
spending about $75,000 for that room.
Yeah, soundproofing is expensive.
It really is. It
good
really
soundproofing.
Is. So, and we're listener sponsored, so it's
right.
not.
So this is all atmosphere, the background stuff.
Yeah,
that's
absolutely.
How we see it.
Absolutely. But I even have a home studio, but that's all the way. It's too far to make me go to.
Oh, sure.
And since you're here only for a limited number of days.
Very limited.
Yeah. So we have only like 5 minutes left,
believe it
or not,
because
we'll also have you
time flies,
and we're going to have you reading a story, and I'll be not only will that be available on live stream,
Right.
But I will be using the same microphone to record you.
Excellent.
So.
Hi, microphone.
Yeah.
We're going to get to be really close.
Yeah. I like my little mic.
Right. It has three legs. Just
it does.
Just for the auditors, it has three legs.
It's got a little Joby stand.
It's a little Triffid thing.
Yeah. Well, it is.
It's like a mini Triffid.
I call it the Triffid.
Oh, nice.
I really do. It's that, or if you bend the legs differently, it's very Wellesian.
Oh, sure, it would be, yes.
But then it would have to need, then the
but
mic
then
would have
it's still
to be cigar
tiny.
Shaped.
It would be like the pop version of the Martians, the pop figures version
right.
of the Martians.
Yes, very much so.
With
and
big eyes. No eyes. It has
little,
no googly eyes.
What were the Shakurs as hats? Is that what they call the Napoleonic Wars has?
Shakos.
Shakos,
it's a
that Shako, was it. Thank you.
Right.
Yeah. So I got a little Shako for a windscreen
right.
here.
So do you have a last question for our last 3 minutes?
No, I have
okay.
a what do you want to... Yes, I do. What do you want to talk about for the last 3 minutes?
For the last three minutes.
There's your question.
There you go.
Aren't I insightful?
Right. Genius.
That's why my CD is called Chatting, not Interviewing.
Right. Nothing. I'm just looking forward to doing the reading. I love reading out loud. I think that hearing a story takes us back to the roots of storytelling, and speaking a story forces us to experience what we've created in a way nothing else does. So I'm actually going to read stuff I haven't read before.
Ooh.
Out loud, except that I read it out loud at my computer, cursing
yeah.
all the while as I fixed all the typos. So I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Reading out loud is one of the great delights in my life.
Yeah, we had a year ago Chip Delaney reading a piece from the Einstein Intersection.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you know, going back how long, and as he was reading, he stopped all of a sudden, took out a blue pencil, made a correction in a book how many years old
that he
hadn't noticed before.
I still edit things that I wrote, things that I have been when I finally did the short story collection, the whole reason I was so thrilled about it, one of the reasons, is that I could finally fix everything.
Yeah.
I could get everything perfect.
Yeah.
And it was an obsessive's dream being able to do that.
So the name of the short story collection is?
The short story collection is At the Mouth of the River of Bees, and that came out from Small Beer a couple years ago. The book that I'm reading from, and the book that came out this year, is The Dream Quest of Velet Bo.
Yes.
And then next year I have a book coming out called The River Bank from
right.
Small Beer again.
Yeah. So, and for that, people can go to smallbeerpress.com.
It's already pre-ordering on Amazon. It's due out in May.
Right.
Which means it'll be out in June.
Yeah. And Small Beer has, oh my God, such a long lead time.
Yeah. Small Beer. And I really enjoyed doing Velet Bo, and I really enjoy working with Small Beer. So,
yeah.
So my loyalties are split.
Well, yeah, but hey, so are Gavin's and
yes,
Kelly's.
Exactly.
So
they
don't have a problem with it. So in terms of radio, we're probably now going to go to your live reading.
All right. And we will go to the live reading.
Now that we've had the live reading, is there anything that you would like to say about it? I can say what a wonderful reading that
there
was.
We go.
It really, oh my God, I just went forward in my TARDIS for
right.
a bit.
You're too kind, I'll say.
I'm
Thank
anticipatory.
You. Yes, that part where I just made it all up and I just started like a free
composing on the
right,
fly.
It was
yeah.
amazing.
That whole James Joyce thing, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it's like word salad. It was a real delight to throw that word salad down like that.
Yeah.
So thank
yeah.
you
yeah.
for the chance to do that.
Thank you so much. I'm sorry this has been so loose and on the cuff.
Nothing wrong with that.
But for a first-time interview, I like to gush more.
We'll be super disciplined next time. We are going to be so focused.
There you go. And what I'm going to do is I will have already gushed because I'll be introducing the interview.
Ah.
You won't even
there
hear
you go.
That. Yeah.
No.
You'll hear it when it happens.
Excellent. Wonderful.
Okay,
that'll be fun.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks. This was fun.
That was an interview with Kitch Johnson recorded this past Tuesday, November 15th. Well, Tuesday a week ago, but what of that? It's a past Tuesday. There have been many past Tuesdays. At any rate, we're going to stick with that particular day, but a few hours later at the second half of the New York Review of Science Fiction readings held on the 15th, Sonia Tafe,
started off, and I promise you, you will be hearing a good deal of her poetry and stories, as well as a rebroadcast of an interview that I did with her last ReaderCon. But today is with Kidge Johnson, so we bring you to that event. Once again, another honor tonight. Kidge Johnson writes short stories and occasional novels, has won the Hugo, Nebula, World Fantasy, and Sturgeon Awards. Her latest books are the Tor.com novella, The Dream Quest of Velet Bow. Now, it's Tor.com, but we have a hard copy. So that is a Tor.com publication as opposed to just a Tor Books thing. It's Macmillan any way you chop it up, right? Yeah, exactly. And Riverbank, A Sly Response to the Wind in the Willows, coming out from Small Beer Press in 2017. Currently, she teaches creative writing at the University of Kansas, where she is also the associate director for the Gunn Center, that's James E. Gunn Center, for the study of science fiction. It is. I don't know why people laugh at that. She spends her time between Seattle and Lawrence, Kansas. Please, everybody, welcome Kidge Johnson.
Thank you, everyone. I'm going to move this thing around a bit because one does. Can you help me adjust this up a little? Because I'm going to need it higher so I can actually meet everybody's beady eyes. So we're going to pretend that this is ichor. It's actually red wine, but we're going to pretend it's slightly gory, sort of bloody stuff. Thanks so much for coming out on a terrible day like today. And thank you, Sonia. That was beautiful. The Catullus poem is absolutely mind-boggling. I'm going to read from Dream Quest of Velet Bow because it came out, and I didn't actually realize that I could choose to read something else, though. So we're going to read from this. However, it is a novella, so we are not going to read the whole thing. At 4 a.m., as I finish it off and you all go home, I'm going to read two sections of it. I'm going to read from the very beginning, and then I'm going to read a sequence in the middle. Ahead of time, things for you to know. I am so tired of reading stories about 20-year-olds, and so tired of reading stories about spunky girls, you know, and stuff like that. And so I wrote this as a response to a number of things that I was having trouble with, one of which was Lovecraft, one of which was yet another, poor impulse control 17-year-old, you know, changing the world. And I will tell you that, I teach writing, and I always tell people you never ever get to start a story with waking up from a dream. But I do feel that when you're writing a story called The Dream Quest of Velet Bow, there's a buy built into that. So we'll start with that. Velet Bow was dreaming of a highway and 10 million birds in an empty sky of featureless blue. The highway, broad and black as a tar pit. The birds, a cloud of them, like a mist writhing, like gnats pillaring over the dark marshes of Lomar, or flickering shoals of silver fish in the crystal seas beyond Oria. The sky, empty, untextured, flat. A great black beast crouching beside her growled steadily, but the birds were louder. One called with a high, sweet voice, and it was saying, "Professor Bow, Professor Bow." Reality returned in rapid stages, the never-absent pain in her back, the softness against her face of sheets worn satin smooth in the college's laundry, the cold air, the moonlight graft by the casemented windows onto the broad, bare floor of her dark bedroom, the percussion of urgent fists, and the voice, soprano but strong, one of the students and afraid, so afraid. "Professor, please, oh gods, please, you must wake up." And she was awake. Velet pushed herself upright in her narrow bed. "Wait," she called, caught her robe from where it lay across her feet, and stepped into her slippers. She went to open the door. It was Dersk Ur, the third-year chemical studies scholar, one hand still raised from the knocking. In the sallow light, Of the hallway's single gas jet, her face was the color of drying mud, and more anxious than Velit had ever seen it. She was dressed in a pajama suit, quite daring, really, but with a country shawl around her shoulders, and she was weeping. Professor Bo, please, please come right away. It's Gerat. Food poisoning in the hall. Scandal. Suicide. There were 1,000 ways a woman's college might find itself destroyed. Clary Gerat was a third year, reading mathematics with Velit, and her best student in 20 years of teaching at Ulthar Women's College. A brilliant girl, strong-willed, charismatic, and beautiful, with long laughing eyes and thick black hair she wore always in a heavy fishtail braid half down her back. Lead me. Velit followed Orr down the stairwell, the girl still sobbing. What about Gerat? Calm down, Orr, or I'll have you on my hands as well. This is not the way an Ulthar woman behaves. Orr paused, pressed her palms against her eyes. I know, I'm sorry, Professor, you're right. I was on my way to bed, and Hoost burst out of their suite just as I was going past, and she said, she's gone, she's run away with him. So Marfeet ran to get the dean, and I came to get you. I don't know anything else. Gerat takes exams in 3 months. When did she have time to meet anyone? Orr turned back down the stairs. I don't know, I'm sure. It was a lie, of course, but the girl said no more. They exited Fellow's Stair and crossed the quad. Only one set of lights shone out from Gerat's windows. Good. The few were awake in the first uncontrolled moments of this situation, whatever it was, the better. The shadows were all moving, visibly shifting as the moon drifted southward on some god's whim. The cold night air was filled with the sharp scents of chrysanthemums and the first fallen leaves, and was so quiet that Velit could hear cats wailing just beyond the college wall. A clouder had congregated within the quad as well. They ceased whatever was their business and watched as Velit and Orr passed, and one, a small black cat, separated itself from the rest and followed them onto Gerat's stairwell. The cold light streaming in through the windows vanished suddenly as the moon passed behind the dining hall's tower, and they were left in the flickering amber of the weak gas jets on each landing. A handful of young women had clustered near Gerat's door, wrapped in bathrobes or shawls or the blankets from the foots of their beds. The college did not waste its funds heating the stairwells. Their voices burst around Velit, high and nervous. She snapped out, women, with the authority of long experience, and they fell silent, their anxious, sleep-worn faces tracking her ascent like poppies, the old women they would become for a moment showing through their youth. There was a circle of space around Gerat's door, the women's curiosity and equipoise with their unwillingness to be associated with whatever crimes she might have committed. Only Thirin Angeli had crossed, weeping soundlessly, as she held Rabba Hoost, the ancient Sarnathian scholar, a heavyset girl with warm brown skin turned the color of ashes and dust in the dim hall light. Hoost was Gerat's roommate. Angeli, Hoost, and Gerat had been close, the three inseparables. Velit announced to the assembled women, "It remains past curfew. Return to your rooms before the dean arrives and finds herself obliged to take notice. I need not remind you that discretion is and must always be a byword of Ulthar women. Do not speak of this, even among yourselves, until we know more, especially to no one outside the college. Miss Hoost, I must detain you for another moment." Without waiting to see her order followed, she disengaged Hoost from Angoli's clinging arms and thrust her into the room to close the door. Gerat and Hoost's sitting room was disordered, the wardrobe doors ajar and clothing distributed over every flat surface. Open-faced books teetered in irregular stacks on the paper-strewn floor, and a tray of dirty crockery from the buttery had been shoved halfway beneath one of the two unmade beds. Even the framed prints on the walls, scenic photographic views of the Naraxa Valley from a generation ago, were crooked. The room looked as though it had been ransacked during a particularly violent abduction, but all the women's students' rooms did these days, as though there were a fad among them of being as sloppy personally as they were disciplined in their studies. Hoost fell into a padded armchair, and with the heedless flexibility of the young, pulled her feet up, wrapping her arms around her knees and hugging them close to her chest. She was still sobbing. As Velit moved piles of old articulations from the two wooden study chairs, there was a brisk knock at the door, followed immediately by the entrance of a small woman with short, grizzled hair and the clever eye of a hunting bird, Ganesa Petso, the dean of Ulthar Women's College. She was dressed in a soft woolen robe, once red but a decade old and dimmed by age and laundering. Without preliminaries, she seated herself on one of the cleared chairs and said briskly, "Hust, every moment is important. What has happened?" Hust gave her a piece of notepaper folded twice. The dean read as Hust said, "When I came back from the library tonight, Gerard wasn't here. That was 9 o'clock, I think. She hadn't said anything to me about being out late, but I assumed she had a late pass to be at a lecture or a reading party, or, but she was flushed, lying." The dean, casting a bright black eye up from the note, said, "Or that she slipped out to be with a man. Miss Hust, do not disgrace yourself, trying to sustain someone else's lie." Hust ducked her head. "I found her letter under my blankets. I've been working on articulations, so she knew I wouldn't see it until late." The dean passed the note to Velit. Clary Gerard's handwriting was as beautiful as everything else about her. "Robba, dear, do not be distressed. You know what this says already, don't you? You always see everything so clearly. I go to be with Stefan. I know it is shocking, but there is such an enormous world, and I cannot see it here. He says there are millions of stars, Robba, millions. Please, show this to Thetherine. I'm sorry for the people who will be hurt, but how could I ever explain this to dear old Prof. Beau, to the dean, to my father? It is impossible. They could not understand. And Stefan tells me it must be tonight or never. And so I go. The greatest adventure, yes? Be happy for me. Your loving Clary." The story was soon told. Clary Gerard had met Stefan Heller when the three inseparables had attended a union debate 4 weeks ago. He had struck up a conversation outside the hall, buying them all coffee at the Crevy. He had been captivated by Gerard. No surprise, Hust said, a little wistfully, for of the inseparables, Robba was the plainest. What was a surprise was that Gerard found him equally attractive. He was good-looking, tawny-skinned and dark-eyed, with excellent teeth and very tall, Hust sighed, but it wasn't any of that. There was just something about him. The next afternoon, it had been tea for Hust and Gerard. Thurine Angoli had been unable to join them because of her maritime economic history tutorial. And then it had been Gerard and Stefan. Stefan and Gerard, weeks and weeks of high teas and low teas and tiffins, of walks through Ulthar's quaint narrow streets and punting upon the Edel, of after-hour bottles of wine shared in the sorts of public places where the Kellerkips did not ask about the university status of young women. That Gerard's studies had not suffered during this month was more a sign of her innate brilliance than of any devotion to her work. And now this. The dean said, "We need to bring her back before this becomes a known thing. Is he a student?" No, Hust rather thought he seemed older than that. "Well, where does he stay? You must know that, yes? She must have said something." Hust hesitated, biting a cuticle. Velit snapped, "I know you have no wish to break silence, Hust, but believe me, this is the right thing to do. We must find her. Do you know who her father is?" "She never talks about her family. What does it matter anyway?" Hust dropped her hand and looked up a little defiantly. The dean explained, "Gerard's father is one of the college's trustees, and he reports to the university's board." Hust said, "She's a grown woman, and she's in love. She's permitted to plan her own life, surely. What's wrong with that?" Velit said, "What's wrong is that her father may have the college shut down." Hust looked aghast. "Oh, surely not." "And perhaps get women banned from the university altogether," said Velit. "This is why we must find her quickly and bring her back. Where does he live?" Hust bit her lip. "I know Heller has been staying at the Spirit Heart. He's not from Ulthar. I thought I said he was special. He's from the waking world. That's where he's taking her." So I'm going to move forward. Things happen and other things happen. It turns out that Velit Beau in her wild and woolly youth was what was called a far traveler. And she traveled much across the lands. And She figures, and justly so, that she's probably the only person who can track Clary Geraut, especially if Clary Geraut has gone to the waking world, because Dreamland people cannot go to the waking world. They don't have the same outlets. They cannot just wake up in our world. So Clary, she follows Clary, or she goes to a place where she finds out that she's going to need a key. And the people who have the keys, there are five keys in the six kingdoms is what the Dreamlands are called to the locals. Of the keys, they're here, they're there. None of them are easy to find, except one of them belongs to somebody named Randolph Carter, who is an old lover of hers in that kind of awkward way that happens when you are a wild and woolly young adventurer. So he is now a king in Ilikvaad. This is all accurate to Lovecraft. I was not breaking Lovecraft. I was just going inside and then just twisting him all around, as was fun. So she has to now sail across to the eastern lands. And this is the only other thing you need to know about this next sequence is that her mother was a sailor, and that was not a popular job for women. So her mother had a lot of trouble getting jobs. And during one of her, when she was a girl, her mother died, vanished at sea, and nobody ever knew why. Her father died shortly afterwards. There are reasons why she must reclaim Clary, because all of Ulthar will be destroyed if she does not. So the stakes are raised. Pro tip there. All right, and also so you know, she has sort of absently acquired a cat that, for reasons that are opaque to everybody, including her, this cat just sort of attached itself, that little black cat in the first scene. And it never does anything that a cat doesn't do, because I don't believe, I didn't want to write an anthropomorphic, wacky, talking cat story. Maybe another day. The ship is called the Megiloic, and it's a Thodi, which is a particular sail configuration. The Megiloic was a beautiful sailor, and with the wind in a fair quarter, the air cool, and the days septiver bright, Velit spent much of her time on the aft deck, watching the land pass, or else gazing up through the layered, complex geometries of the wine-colored lateen and settee sails to the foliant sky above. The man she had identified as another far traveler also preferred the aft deck, and they spoke occasionally, as when he pointed out the flying city Saranian, so far to port and so high that she could barely see the pink marble towers against pillaring cumulus clouds. Tyr Leshwitrin was his name. This was shore hopping, the land always in sight to starboard. They passed the jungles of Kled, league after league of rolling hills above rocky shoreline, cloaked entirely in a surprising lush green, for the trees of Kled did not lose their leaves in winter. The air was rich with spices and flowers, and she took in great lungsful. At night, she saw scatterings of light ashore, as if towns lit by gaslight or even electricity. At first, she ate in the crowded dining room, but the other passengers had little to say to her, and she found their conversation, all of trade and card games, dull. So she began to take her meals in the main cabin, reading books she found on the crowded shelves or content in her thoughts. She was joined sometimes by Tyr Leshwitrin, or one or two of the others. The most frequent was the youngest of the Klethi traders, who eyed her with a certain awed fascination and spoke with her as if she were 80 instead of 55, asking questions about events of ancient history as though she might have been a witness, loudly, slowly, and with great courtesy. On the fourth day, they rounded a cape, and there was a single pinnacle of pure labradorite rising 100 feet above the waves. In the septiver mid-afternoon sun, it was striated purple and gray and blue, like the wing of a grackle, but her memories of other voyages overlaid the view. A stormy mid-morning, a year after her father's death, when the stone had seemed to shine with an inner violet light. A summer afternoon, when the pinnacle looked nearly lavender. A night, when she had stood on the ship's deck with a man and the pinnacle had been a spear of platinum aimed at the full moon resting overhead. But she remembered the kiss more than the rock. On the morning of the eighth day, the Thoth tied it into the port of Flaneth. Passengers and cargo were to be exchanged, but the captain was eager for a fast return to the sea. 24 hours, he told Velet, I'll sail with or without you. Klanath had much the look of Ulthar, but sturdier, as indeed it had to be, a port town facing north. Contact was frequent between the towns along a pikeway through the Carthian hills, and since becoming a professor, she had visited more than once in her summer term ramblings. It took no time to locate the last few oddments needed for the voyage. She stopped for tiffin at a little tea house she remembered from years past. It would be weeks before she ate greens again. She wrote and posted yet another letter to the dean. It felt repetitive, tedious to write. On my way, still going. Yes, indeed, another day traveling. But it needed to be done to keep Ganesa and the college informed. More than that, it anchored her to her mission and her home. For as the miles of her journey multiplied, Ulthar was becoming remote, distant, in the past. She was wandering toward the harbor and considering Clary Gerat, wondering whether she was also walking along a busy street and where, when she felt herself jostled. She did not think anything, only spun on her heel and grasped the arm of the man who had touched her and found his hand just leaving the outer pocket of her jacket, empty. He twisted away and fled, a tall man, pale as winter hay. She leaned against a wall, waiting for her sudden shaking to subside. It was good to know she was still no easy prey, but it took a long time to calm her hurried heartbeat. Of all the passengers, only Tirlesh Witren and the four traders from Kled remained. The five new passengers were tough-looking men, couriers, an accomptant with documents for Ilik Vad, a reeve representing a man with international interests. There was a harder edge to the crew as well, for after this they would leave the comparative safety of the coast. It would be blue water sailing until they got to the Eastlands. Two priests came aboard as the Medjeloic prepared to cast off from Planeth, attired in layered robes of blue and black wool richly embroidered with silver thread. Their faces were concealed behind panels of silver mesh. They moved clumsily, bulkily, and water pooled beneath them on the scoured teakwood deck. Since the blue water rituals were forbidden to landsmen, Velet found herself banned to her cabin. When she came on deck again, the Thodi was at sea. By morning, they were out of sight of land. Distance in the Dreamlands was never constant, and the seas were even less stable. Randolph Carter had once made the passage from Planeth to Caliphias in 3 days, a feat that was legend, but 3 weeks sailing between the two was more usual, and even 6 weeks or more not uncommon, and the Medj's destination, Ogrothon, was farther than Caliphias. And then back, if all went well, and Randolph Carter gave her the key, she counted the days over in her mind, an unhappy arithmetic. Could the college conceal Clary Gerard's absence so long? Did the university know yet? Were steps being taken to suspend or close the college? Well, little spoiler, we'll jump forward. The town was hundreds of leagues away, but sometimes she couldn't help but scan the southern horizon for fire and smoke. Septiver turned to Octiver, and the days grew colder, until she lamented the yak wool scarf on her bunk. Velet paced the decks and distracted herself with the complex topologies of the wind-filled sails and the sky so low that it seemed the mainmast might snag on its vague ungeometries, weighty as a tent roof pregnant with captured rain on the brink of squeezing through the canvas. There was little else to see. The Medjeloic sailed alone in a circle of sea 20 leagues across. Only once did they see another ship, a caravel that revealed itself as a pirate when it pursued them for an entire light-winded day in a leisurely chase that ended with darkness. Another day, there was a whale spume on the horizon, and once, miles to the north, a calm gull on the water as long as the Medjeloic, which was, she was told, a Kraken's tentacle club floating just beneath the surface. There were nights when the elapsing time chewed at her and she could not sleep. Tirlesh Witren and the reeve who had boarded in Klanath were often awake into the night watches, so she joined them sometimes in the main cabin, stepping into their endless games of chess, but neither of them were a match for her, and Tirlesh made her uncomfortable. He watched her, his eyes too steady. He asked too many questions about her past, about her destination. Had she been 20 instead of 55, she might have assumed it was desire, or a mere opportunist gauging of his chances, or even imagined illusory love. But there were 25 years between them, and it was impossible to suppose any of these drove him. So perhaps it was only curiosity. But she avoided him when she could, and when she could not, she offered a bland, damping, slightly chilling civility she had honed across a lifetime. Many nights she chose to walk on deck, the lowered voices of the watch at their work, the softly glowing wake. The moon was often gone, so she watched the seething sky behind the 97 stars, daylight's blues replaced with 1,000 blacks, black tinged with red, with brown, with a poisonous green so dark it was almost undetectable, all tumbled together in churning boils the size of planets. When she had been younger, and her eyes fresher, she had seen it better. Randolph Carter had told her once that the waking world sky was not like this. "It's just empty," he had said. "No patterns, no changing, except clouds and the time of day." They had been camped in Implan's Bonny Hills that night, 3 days out from Unai along the trade route that led to Hathic Town. They had set no fire. She shook her head a little impatient. "I know, you showed me the picture, but beyond the atmosphere, behind the air." "Nothing," he said. "After the atmosphere of Earth, you're in space, which is vacuum. Well, there are stars, billions, I suppose, and nebulae and gas clouds, but they exist in the infinity of space. I'm no astronomer." "So many stars," she mused. "Do they all have gods? How do they not annihilate one another?" "It's not the same in the real world." By real, he meant Earth. She tried to picture it. "If the sky is infinite, why would you come here with so many stars of your own?" "Our world has no sweep, no scale," Carter said, "no dark poetry. We can't get to the stars, and even the moon is hundreds of thousands of miles away. There's no meaning to any of it." "Do stars have to mean anything?" she asked. But he reached across and kissed her, and that had ended that conversation, as it had ended so many others. She remembered Clary Gerard's letter. "He says there are millions of stars." She was presumably on Earth by now, with her waking world lover. She would have seen his sky. Perhaps he had taken her to his home. Stefan Heller was a great dreamer here. Surely he must be as powerful in his own place. He would have a palace, an estate of some sort. And she, with the charm of a spoiler here, he could hardly fail to love her utterly. He would marry her, and she would become chatelaine of whatever lands were his, rich, respected, and adored. It was a pity she could not be left there. But at other times, Velit thought of Clary's father, Devel Gerard. She had met him often enough. The trustees of Ulthar Women's College were invited to incepts and late last nights, holiday dinners, the college's annual report, and the alumni moot, and Devel took his duty seriously. He was already a widower when Velit first came to teach, but senior dayroom gossip said that his wife had been truly beautiful, a Lingtro sculpture, Ganesa Petso had once said with a sigh, for her tastes ran to such. Some people had wondered at their marriage, for Devel was a short man with a crooked jaw and a pugged nose, but Devel's humor and glowing charm were extraordinary, even shadowed by the loss of his wife and the accumulating weight of years. Velit saw Devel and Clary Gerard together at her incept. His expression as he watched her take student robes for the first time had been a complex mixture of love, pride, and a terrible tender fear that made Velit look away. It was so strong. It must be 10,000 times worse for him now, if Ulthar still stood. And then, frustrated with her circling thoughts, she would distract herself by watching the luminescent wavering chevrons of their wake fade back to darkness, or by gazing at the mysterious glowing disks clustering in the ocean's depths. The disks intrigued her, and night after night she watched them, patches of indistinct phosphorescence, roughly circular, and no larger than her hand, she thought. She imagined they might be jellyfish, but when she asked a crew member, he only made the elder sign and spat over the railing. Later, the captain came to her, where she stood at the aft rail and ordered her never to speak of them again. His voice was harsher than she had ever heard it, even to his crew members, so she complied, and thereafter kept to herself her observations of how they moved, changed size, overlapped, and absorbed one another. There was a half-mooned night, 19 days into the Blue Water Passage, when she saw the little glowing circle scatter as though fleeing from some unseen predator. One grew larger, and then larger still, and she realized that it was not small, but had been instead very, very far away, beneath hundreds of fathoms of winter clear water. It grew and grew, a wheeling diatom that increased in clarity and complexity until it was the size of a house, the size of a galleon, the size of a city, filling the ocean beneath them from horizon to horizon. She observed details now, glowing windowless towers and five-sided structures, giant pentangular basins everywhere blazing with cold bioluminescence, the radial lines broadening until she could see countless smaller shapes streaming along them like platelets in a capillary under a microscope, or men racing in a panic along a crowded street. It seemed certain that the Megiloic would be shipwrecked, beached among whatever strange entities raced along those radial roads, but it sheered to starboard as it rose larger and then larger still, until miles away, it broke the surface with a sound like a hurricane and wheeled up into the sky, high enough to occlude the gibbous moon, and its phosphorescence died in the air so that nothing more could be seen of the things that lived in that place. It crashed back into the water, faster than gravity could pull. It was only then that Velet remembered that this diatom city had been fleeing something, and it had not escaped. An unseen maw, immeasurably vast and hungry, had sucked it back down the way the carp had sucked the dead bird into its scarlet mouth back on the raffles so long ago. It took minutes for the chaos of jumbled water to get to them, ample time for the captain and his crew to turn the Thodi into the waves, and a quarter of an hour more for the bursting seas to settle at last. It took much longer for Velet to stop thinking of her mother's death. Had her father imagined this? I'll stop. Thank you. Thank you so much.
That was Kidge Johnson performing at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings on Tuesday, November 15th of 2016. This program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. Thank you so much for listening. I will be back next week from 1:30 a.m. till 3, I believe. And until then, please, everybody, now more than ever, be good to each other. Take care, and happy turkey.
And you're in tune to radio station WBAI 99.5 FM New York, WBAI.org. Jim Freund returns live right here at 99.5 FM New York, WBAI. Next week, same place, same time. Hour of the Wolf.
This is Harvey Pekar, and you're tuned to WBAI, listener-supported radio in New York. Is that okay? What do you want me to do, a bunch of them?
Do you know why I pulled you over today, sir?
Because I'm black.
From November 25th to December 11th, the African Diaspora International Film Festival celebrates black life on the big screen with over 60 entertaining and revealing fiction and documentary films, including 34 U.S. and New York premieres. Themed programs include Spotlight on Nigerian Cinema, the Afro-Latino Program, Black Australia on Film, The Senegal Connection, and more. Discover the films Driving While Black, Spirits of Rebellion, Invisible Roots, Afro-Mexicans in Southern California, and Toussaint Louverture. That's the African Diaspora International Film Festival, November 25th to December 11th. For tickets and schedule, go to nyadiff.org on the web or call 212-864-1760. That's 212-864-1760.
And it's 3 o'clock, New York City.
With the election of Donald Trump as president, many media organizations have a grave concern as we face the possibility of censorship from this administration. As a listener, you know WBAI has been the singular, truly progressive community voice in the tri-state area for over 55 years, giving voice to oppressed communities and perspectives ignored by the mainstream media. WBAI is gearing up to report deeply with courage and authenticity on the troubling events we see promised by the incoming administration. As a non-commercial radio station, it has become more crucial than ever that WBAI have the financial support required to remain the powerful, progressive community information hub it has been historically. Please consider supporting WBAI by becoming a BAI buddy, a monthly subscriber. Become a monthly donor now. For $10, $50, $100, or even $5,000 between now and the end of Giving Tuesday, November 29th. Your donation gets you a BAI Buddy tote bag and a buddy card for discounts around town. Also, one BAI Buddy will receive a dinner for two at 11 Madison Park, the number 4 ranked restaurant in the country. Several of you will also have your names drawn to attend WBAI's annual Everything Old is New Again holiday concert on Sunday, December 4th at the Metropolitan Room. So do it now. Go to givetowbai.org and become a BAI buddy in the name of your favorite show or call us at 516-620-3602. That's right. Forget Black Friday. Ignore Cyber Monday. Remember BAI on Giving Tuesday. You have our back. We'll have yours.
For WBAI News in New York, I'm Linda Perry. While the mainstream media normalizes Donald Trump's transition to power, what we've already seen is more than cause for alarm. Jeff Sessions for Attorney General and Trump pick, white nationalists can love. General Michael Flynn, foreign national security advisor, he says fear of Muslims is irrational. And Steve Bannon, as chief strategist and White House counselor, gets a thumbs up from the KKK. This is a time to organize and stand for what is just, a time to stand against hate and bigotry, and a time to stand together, a time to support your listener-sponsored non-commercial radio station. Please go to give2wbai.org. Go there now, give2wbai.org, and become a WBAI buddy. And thank you.
December 9, 2016 marked the 35th anniversary since the police attempted to kill Mumia Abu-Jamal on the streets of Philadelphia. Now that Mumia is no longer on death row, the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections is denying Mumia and thousands of others similarly infected with hepatitis C life-saving medication. Join international concerned family and friends of Mumia Abu-Jamal on Friday, December 9, 3 p.m. in Center City, Philadelphia, as we rally and demand treatment for those infected with hepatitis C, clean water, and demand the legal proceedings to proceed that could lead to Mumia's case being overturned. To reserve a seat on the bus, call the Free Mumia Hotline at 212-330-8029 or visit freemumia.com.
Hi, this is Gil Scott here, an unknown bluesologist, speaking to you on Free Speech Radio, WBAI 99.
When I leave, you can feel my stead with the last words on my lips. I am a revolutionary, and you're going to have to keep on saying that. You're going to have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the best. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Hello, I'm Lister. Today is a terrorist holiday, Misgiving Day, in imperialist USA. A day when the imperialist pigs celebrate the genocide of indigenous folks.
Red, white, and blue, I'm not Captain America. Too black, too strong, causing mass hysteria. Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself. Torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control. So they force obedience. Have you pledged allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk. Cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though. That's my right in this writing. The Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion. Huh, suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover. The red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag like many others. Take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too.
Panama, talking about Peru, Azania. Boston, Belfast, can't forget Korea, Beirut, can't forget Haiti, Iran, Puerto Rico, Colombia, Mexico, talking about Uptown, Harlem, New York City, y'all, and Nicaragua, East and South Central LA, California, IA, Miami, do or die, Bed-Stuy, never ran, never will, Brownsville, boogie down, South Bronx, yeah.
My man Joey to jail, and now they got him in court because he burned the flag.
Not before.
That's the name of the game. Well, I quit playing. I doubt the suckers want you to hear what I'm saying about this nation. Freedom supposed to be the format, but I step on your flag like it's a floor mat. Maim and mangle, the star spangle. I'm not trying to diss you. I use the flag like toilet tissue to wipe my black ass. What? You think that I'm a jackass? I see a flag and I attack fast with some fire. My desire to burn what Betty Ross sold up. The truth I show up about America, America, home. Free. Boom. This is the home of the slave. Now hold on just a mother minute. You gave me freedom of speech in the First Amendment. So why wanna scold me when I toss you the flag? I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, America too. See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
This is the track, and it stays on, right?
Yo, Chuck E, what's up? They're accusing the black is gonna cost them. The same trap that they pulled up there in Boston. Blaming us for a crime without them checking the time. That's why I'm down with Al. Plus the FOI. Don't get caught in between the evil, good, and the mean. Cause they'll get you in their fucking anti-machine.
This is the track listed as I never got no credit for it and all that, but that's okay. Anti-nigga machine.
This is what I mean, an anti-machine. Instead of peace, the police just want to wreck and flex. On a kid, what I did was try to be the best. But so they fingered the trigger, figure I was a bigger. And they started to search me, so I headed west. When the Cali and rally was for a brother's death, it was the bloods who shot him and not the pleasant cuz. I wondered why I was like, so I just held my mic. But in my mind, I was blind, so I just tried to find a reason we was just the way that we was. So I just stayed in the crib until I got a buzz.
And I'm a rebel with a cause. 99 Cinco, list alive, the anti-nigga machine. Track that list is on the way, got no credit, but that's okay. Burn, baby, burn, y'all.
Rebel with a cause.
You're just joining us for the first time. This is Misgiving Day, better known as Indigenous Peoples Day. The pushback against the genocide by the imperialist kings, dogs, Dakota.
Sometimes they don't have a bite to eat. Struggling for survival. Every day I'll ring the bell.
Hell yeah.
It's time.
Hell yeah.
It's time.
12 minutes after 3 o'clock, burning imperialists, red, white, and blue, all glory. Burning it until 5 o'clock this morning, 99 Cinco Clappers.
Just because of the cause that they have caused you. Rebel with your cause, just because of the cause.
Genocide against the Lakota people, Misgiving Day.